Sip Podcast. Wanna know what's happening to Steve? Sip Podcast. Don't you know it's Grierson and Leach? Grierson and Leach. Grierson and Leach. Don't you know it's Grierson and Leach?
Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And hi, I'm Will Leach, and this is the Grierson Leach Podcast, episode 161. Grierson, I come to you live from Florida. I am a Florida man. As I speak to you, I'm making my yearly trip to Jupiter, Florida, to spend time with my wife and her father, along with the more important than them, the St. Louis Cardinals at spring training. A very exciting time, good times all around. We don't really get into that, though, because I'm in Florida, and you know, which means if you never hear from me again, you'll know why. I got attacked by a gator or a local citizen. But I want to talk to you about, briefly, before we get going, about Documentary Now. Have you been watching Documentary Now, Grierson?
I've only watched the first episode of this season. So I have two
more. Both parts? Both parts? Or the hour? There's two parts or two halves to the first part.
Yes.
The Owen Wilson one.
Yes. You know, actually, I would take it back. I realize I haven't seen that one. I saw the company episode, the co-op episode.
I haven't seen
the first one. I've seen co-op, and I haven't seen the Artist is Present episode yet.
Yeah, Documentary Now is a show that, like, I feel like is both made specifically for me and also not for me. It's a really weird sensation watching Documentary Now because I find myself going, oh, I totally get all these references, but not liking it as much as I'm supposed to.
Yeah, it's definitely a show that I remember when it first premiered, I reviewed it, like the first like four episodes for The Wrap, and I really, really loved it. And I kind of kept watching it as it went along, and I actually do really enjoy it. Jiro Dreams of Fish episode is especially terrific, I think. It's really, really well done. It's funny because I definitely feel like it is a show that lends itself to a certain play to the back of the room vibe, if you know what I mean. The stand-ups talk about that, the idea of like the stand-up comics on stage are only performing in a sense to the other comics in the back of the room who sort of appreciate the jokes that they're doing, whereas maybe the audience itself does not. That being said, I do think the show is really, really clever and well done. I think it is basically kind of lives and dies by how well they riff off the documentary that they're referencing. Like, for instance, like for me, the Salesman episode, I love Salesman. It's one of my favorite documentaries. And I thought that episode was good, but it definitely was like, hey, this is from Salesman. I'm like, yeah, no, I know. I know that's what you're doing. So I definitely like it and find it pretty, sometimes I think it is more clever than it is sort of brilliant or hilarious. But that being said, you know, John Mulaney with that hair and those pants, that sustains you for a half an hour. Let's not be too critical about these things. Yeah,
it does. I don't think I listen to enough comedy podcasts to truly love Documentary Now. That makes sense too. That probably makes sense, right? People that are really into comedy podcasts. That's what you mean, like the back of the room stuff. Like, oh, you know, a little bit, you know, like that the cool comedy kids. I just don't listen to enough of those.
I think
also,
you're cool.
I have a Fred Armisen allergy. I will confess. I have a little bit of a Fred Armisen allergy.
Have you gone back and watched the Wilco documentary since you've gone to this Wilco thing, by the way, out of curiosity?
No, I haven't.
Because he's in the documentary.
The original one?
In the one about the making of Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. The one
I'm trying to break your heart? Armisen's in that?
Yeah, he's in that, yeah.
What the hell's he doing in there?
He and Jeff Tweedy have a moment where they sort of riff on like property values and stuff like that, which is just a joke.
No, I'm not going to go back and watch it now.
It won't help your allergy, put it that way. It will not help.
I don't even like Wilco anymore. I just like suddenly started hating the band. This is the Grierson Podcast, episode 161. Reminding you, as always, follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach. Apparently, we're on Facebook and Instagram. Email us, GriersonLeach@gmail.com. Go to our website, GriersonLeach.com. Go to GriersonLeach.com/RSVP. To see a list of every single movie we've talked about on this here podcast. Something Sounds by Dylan Mayer on Cuthbert Avenue. Find on Bandcamp, SoundCloud, Clothing Sounds, My Friend Mary. Short Songs and Melancholy Longings. Facebook page, My Friend Mary. We also have a t-shirt, right, Grierson?
I know where it is. Do you know where it is?
I have no idea.
It's cottonbureau.com.
Cottonbureau.com. That makes sense. That rings a bell. Go to cottonbureau.com, type in Grierson Leach, get a t-shirt, get porked. You should subscribe to us, by the way. Subscribe to us on Google Play, Stitcher, Overcast, SoundCloud, Spotify, iHeartRadio. But the best place to find every single new podcast the minute it goes up is on Apple Podcasts /iTunes. And if you do, are there, and you give us a review, 5 stars, please, and give us the name of a movie you would like to discuss in our reboot section, we will do so. We have a reboot movie this week. I believe I know who this is from. This is from my friend Julia, the great Julia, the co-purveyor of the Cardinals, New York City Cardinals bar in Foley's, if you're ever there. I actually have a signed baseball in one of the windows there. I assume now.
Was that where you won your 300th game?
They have a lot of actual people, but I think I just bought enough beer that they were like, here, have a spot in the corner. There's like mustard stains. I don't even eat mustard. I think they were just like out of napkins one day and here, take this ball. But nevertheless, the great Julia from the Cardinals Bar, Foley's, and also from like many other places, but the co-purveyor of the Cardinals fan group. If you're in New York City and you like the Cardinals, go to Foley's for opening day. Good times. Anyway, Julia is awesome in many other ways, including the fact that she's worked on Broadway for years and years and years.
Broadway.
And she's great. She's awesome. She's the best. And she gets says really fun 5 stars, really fun movie discussions. Love the podcast from these two very smart fellas. As an old movie nerd, I especially love the reboot section. My request, please review Billy Wilder's The Apartment, or as it is known in Germany, El Appartamento. and as it is known in England, The Flat. Anyway, so in our reboot section, we'll be discussing.
Wait, did she say that or did you say that, Will?
No, that's all me.
Okay, I want to make it very clear to this lovely sounding woman who's very complimentary of us. Those bad jokes were not what she wrote. Will did that part. That's Will. That's all Will.
I'm simply being informational. Anyway.
Did you know in England it's called The Flat?
It's called The Flat. Anyway, so we'll be discussing The Apartment. However, we have one big new movie to discuss, and then Grierson is going to go solo a little bit because I want to see both the movies he's talking about. So he's going to go solo in the middle when talking about Gloria Bell and Apollo 11. That's the one that made it to the moon, right?
Don't ruin it.
Sorry, they made it.
Just because you signed baseball doesn't mean you give the right to ruin movies for our audience.
With mustard stains. However, we got a big new movie to discuss. Big hit, this movie. Grierson, the kids like it. The movie is Captain Marvel.
Your life began the day it nearly ended. We found you. With no memory, we made you one of us. So you could live longer, stronger, superior. You were reborn.
I keep having these memories. Something in my past is the key to all of this.
You know how to fly this thing?
We'll see.
That's a yes or no question.
Captain Marvel is directed by Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck. You may recognize them from such movies as... What's the one where where Ryan Gosling's the drug addict?
Half Nelson.
Half Nelson. That movie is pretty good. I like that movie. Sugar. They did Sugar. Didn't they
do
Sugar?
They did do Sugar.
Yeah, that movie's good. Mississippi Grind. That's a good movie. Yeah, they did some pretty good movies over here. Mississippi, it's kind of a funny story written by the late Nate Vizzini. Good people, those two. This is their, as this tends to be the case these days, these are independent filmmakers going to getting to the big leagues and doing a Marvel movie. This one revolved, it's an origin story. I think this is, I counted this up when I wrote my review for Pace. I think this is the 9th origin story. I think that's 8th or 9th. The 8th or 9th Marvel origin story. This one involves Captain Marvel. Captain Marvel is actually a woman named Carol Danvers. Carol Danvers. Sure, let's go with that. Yes, Carol Danvers, or Vers, as we find out later, is another name for her. Played by Brie Larson. Now, when we first meet her, she is already a futuristic warrior. At least it seems futuristic. Mm-hmm. Where she's fighting some sort of, with the Krees. I know the Krees are like a big thing in the Marvel world. This happens every time we talk about a Marvel movie. There's a certain base understanding that really hardcore Marvel people have that always takes me 5 or 10 minutes into the movie to remember. Oh, right. Okay, that's the Kree. And there's like this. I never remember any of it. I think this movie, even though it is an origin story, does not spend a lot of time being like, oh, do you remember the Krees? Well, they're fighting the Skrulls. Like, it doesn't really do any of that.
We should start our podcast by doing it. Hey, you remember the Kree?
Yeah. It's like 10 minutes before I realize, oh, right, that's right. That's from these people. Anyway, so she's like, of course, she's being trained because she's a young warrior, but she also, as tends to be the case, does not know where she does not know her own backstory. She's like, she kind of has a memory loss. She's just like, next thing she knows, she's like this superhero. She's being trained by Jude Law, who plays a character who's not named Jude Law, but I've looked at the name and there are many hyphens and like a bunch of vowels in a row that indicate alien. So I'm just going to call him Jude Law because that is the name of the actor. He kind of is training her and so on. And then they get involved in this big battle and she crashes onto this planet that turns out to have a name other than Earth. But hey, it turns out it's Earth. And you notice, as you may remember from the trailer, she falls into a Blockbuster Video, which is the best way to signal to everyone, this is in the 90s. This is in 1995 specifically. So therefore, once she's there, she has to figure out how to win this ongoing war and team up with, as it turns out, a younger Samuel L. Jackson, a younger Nick Fury, also a younger Agent Coulson, played by Clark Gregg. While she's there, she also runs into, she has to figure out, Annette Bening, she runs into her, she's trying to figure out her own past. She also runs into this alien played by Ben Mendelsohn, who is very, very funny and awesome and everything, and also just a great actor, even in Netflix movies that Grierson doesn't like.
He's talking about the Nicole Holofcener movie, which is okay.
It's perfectly fine. He's really good in it. Anyway, the point is, it is a Marvel movie. It is a Marvel origin movie. If you remember in the closing credits thing of the last Avengers movie, Nick Fury, right before he gets put into the ash thing by the bad guy snapping his fingers...
Thanos.
Charlize Theron. Yes. Charlize
Thermos. It was Thermos who turned him into.
Yes. Anyway, the point is, so Samuel L. Jackson, you remember Nick Fury like sends like a little pager to, and it turns out he sent it to Captain Marvel. This kind of explains how that happened and how they kind of, their relationship kind of got put together. Now, anytime you're talking about a movie like Captain Marvel, you have to do many. There's so many things that are happening outside of the movie itself. There is, and by that I mean not just. We'll get into the whole. There's a lady leading a Marvel movie thing in a moment, but also like this movie has so many kind of masters to serve, as we talk about often with these Marvel movies. Not only does it have to introduce this new character, it has to explain why she's so trusted to be able to. Be the one that's going to apparently come in the second Avengers movie and help save everyone. It also has to connect to the overarching world, including this Kree thing that I really don't really understand or care about. And it also has to then show that she, after presumably the next Avengers movie, ends Phase 3, I think it is, of all the Marvel movies, where I assume we're going to lose some of the older Marvel characters and transition into some of the newer Marvel characters, including Captain Marvel, who I would assume will hang around for a while, considering her name is Captain Marvel. It seems like she's not going anywhere. So the movie has a lot of different things to do and a lot of heavy lifting that it has to do in that regard before it even gets a chance to actually tell the story of this person. In addition to that, it has all the weight on its shoulders of being the first female-led Marvel movie, which I have to tell you, I don't mean to be like, oh, well, I'm so evolved, but I have to say, I know it is the first one, but I do, I mean, I did, with the success of Wonder Woman, and it doesn't strike me as like, wow, what a jaw-dropping moment, because I am a white dude, and I'm just used to this crap at this point, but also, like, it feels like, It surprised me, I'll put it this way, that there was such an immediate backlash. To be fair, I think it is worth reminding, in particular when you see the box office notions of all the box office numbers for all this stuff, that backlash may have been like 5 or 10 people hitting repeat on Twitter, which I think is probably the more accurate way that actually happened, because people still were very excited this movie and made a lot of money. I find it weird to see some of the reactions to how much money this movie made, had a bunch of people say, yeah! Awesome. Suck it, jerks. Well, yes, suck it, jerks. Who cares about those people? This film is like a movie, and I feel like, and for me, The idea that having to be like, you look at a movie like Black Panther. I like Black Panther more than you, but Black Panther is a movie that you can tell it suck at jerks to a lot of people, but also really rises up to the moment. I think you could argue Wonder Woman is another movie that kind of rises up to the moment. This movie is fine. This movie is absolutely fine. It is a I would say it's above replacement level, but it is average Marvel distribution system. I think that like some stuff works. I think she in particular is really good. I think that this she carries this movie a long way. This character is one we've frankly seen a lot before. Someone loses the memory, has to figure out who they are, and then discovers that they have a strength within them that they didn't realize they had the entire time. And belief in themselves will make them more powerful than they ever could have realized. I feel like I've seen that movie dozens of times. I think I've seen like 6 Harry Potter movies like that. Like that is a plotline we have seen over and over and over. She has a lot of work she has to do, but she's so good. There's one scene in particular, kind of a climactic moment of the movie that like brings kind of her storyline of like being pushed over and being pushed past. I think will mean a lot to a lot of people. And I think it's very effective. Other than that, everything else feels like mostly average Marvel stuff. The villain is not particularly interesting. I think there's some good. The fight scenes I think are pretty bad, to be honest. They almost feel like maybe Bowden and Fleck are just not very good at them, and they just had to put someone else in to scramble them up because they're very dark and they look very muddled. They're hard to follow, and that's something that I think Marvel generally does pretty well, particularly of late. And I don't think they work very well here at all. That said, the technology they use to make Samuel L. Jackson look 20 years younger, I would argue, is completely flawless. There's not one moment where I found myself watching it and I just kind of accept it immediately. So I thought that was impressive. I think Ben Mendelsohn is funny in this movie, but I feel like this is a story I've seen a million times before. This feels like another Doctor Strange, to be honest. Like, I feel like there's more going on because I think that, like, Brie Larson is particularly invested in this performance. And I think in an extra textual way, it is kind of cool to see a woman this powerful and this strong in this movie. But as an origin story and as an actual piece of storytelling, it really felt like Doctor Strange level, which is fine, but nothing particularly inspiring.
You are almost exactly aligned with where I am on this movie. In fact, I actually wrote a piece that's going to run on Monday for Mel, where I basically wrote about the fact that, like, the worst thing about this movie is people's expectations of wanting it to be great. Because, you know, it's a movie that has a lot riding on it in ways that, to use an example, Doctor Strange does not have. The Guardians of the Galaxy does not have. And while I'm also rooting for this movie to do well and, you know, wish the movie nothing, you know, have nothing but good feelings about the film, it's just okay. It's good enough. That's exactly how I feel about it. It is a good enough movie for a lot of the reasons that you say. I think she's, Brie Larson's really good in it. And the thing I especially like about her in the movie is that I think that she has, as an actress, as a public persona, has struggled a bit since she was announced as Captain Marvel. And partly it's because, as she has said often, she is very introverted as a person. And so the biggest challenge that she knew she was going to have in terms of playing this character is doing the promotional work for it, because she is not necessarily maybe inclined to be the lively, fun presence that, frankly, a lot of the other Marvel actors actually kind of are.
Kind of half the job. It feels like it's like half the job, right?
Yeah, but even like I would say that, and this is sort of an interesting sort of like sexist sort of thing to sort of think about, but like Chris Evans has long talked about the fact that he really sort of struggles with this whole stardom thing. But when he is interviewed and when he is approached about this stuff and when he is profiled, it tends to be, oh, the serious actor is having a conflict of conscience about the art that he makes versus the commercial considerations of it. Brie Larson, it tends to be, hey, why is she so like, you know, stuck up? Which I think is sort of an interesting sort of sexist thing going on. That being said, the problem that the movie has is it's not like Wonder Woman or Black Panther, both movies I prefer to this movie, because those movies, I think, inherently understood and rose to the challenge of saying, we know what you're expecting from this movie. We know what's on our shoulders, and we're going to incorporate that in some ways into the films. whether it's subconsciously or not. I think that's in those movies. I would also, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse also leans into that in a way that understands the moment in time in which it's being created and embraces it in a way that is actually emotional and inspiring as a viewer. It is interesting, I think, that Captain Marvel doesn't necessarily do that. I think there is a certain amount of, to be very, you know, simplistic about it, you know, female empowerment, you know, girl power kind of thing. There are elements of it, but it's not as, I don't think it is as bracing and poignant and as powerful as it is in those previous movies. Now, you can make the argument that that's actually a good sign, or it's a sign of progress, that this movie didn't feel the pressure of it. But at the same time, I think it's a lot of, it may not be very strong in this movie, but it is carrying the emotional weight of the movie. I can't get into this part because it's a spoiler, but I actually think there's also really another interesting element going on in this movie in terms of judging people who are not like yourself. But I don't want to say anything more than that. I think that's actually the most interesting, like, thematic element going on in this movie, but even that is not super great. This movie is, I haven't read a ton of the reviews, to be honest, because I knew that you had reviewed this for Paste Will, and so I wanted to not stumble upon your review by accident before we talked. And so I really haven't seen many of the reviews, but the thing that has slipped out, in terms of what people are talking about with this movie is, how awesome is the cat? And to me, that's kind of part of what the problem with this movie is, which is the cat is fine. But to me, the cat in this movie, who is a stowaway, who becomes part of the team in a humorous way, is, it feels like one of those throwaway things that the internet loves, but I am more like, yeah, that's fine, but it's more just kind of like the comic relief in the film, and shouldn't there be more to it than this? One of the things you didn't mention, Will, which I am very mixed feelings about, is the amount of 90s nostalgia in this film. The music choices in this movie are half good, half eye-rolling.
May I interrupt for just
please,
a moment, Grayson?
Go for it.
One of the things that I wrote a weekly newsletter, tinyletter.com/WilliamFLH, and my entire newsletter this week, which Grayson has not read, because it starts with the words Captain Marvel, so he made sure not to actually read these, though he may never read any of them, who knows, is literally all about exactly what you're talking about. The musical choices, movies, half you're like, all right, hey, that's a good one, and then half just like, ugh. And I worry this is someone that loves 90s music, that the fear is always like, this is like, wait, are people really going to think that No Doubt was like the big band of the 90s? And why did she turn out to be the natural culturing figure? But you realize that what they're doing, they're not actually trying to conjure up to 1995. They're trying to show, like, they're not trying to actually make you feel like you're in 1995. They're just trying to indicate things to let you know that it is 1995, as opposed to accurately represent 1995.
Yeah, as someone who has hated that No Doubt song for almost 25 years now, it's showing up in what I would say is an on-the-nose moment that isn't fun enough, because I agree with you, Will. I think the action sequences in this movie are just okay, and that one is below just okay, I would say. That was sort of disappointing. The director of Zama, Lucretia Martel, has been telling a story, or told a story, where Marvel actually met with her. You know, she's a she's an Argentinian filmmaker who has never sniffed anything remotely commercial in her entire life. Her movies are very sort of distinctive and auteurist. But she had a meeting with Marvel where, as she tells in this story, they were like, oh, you know, but don't worry, you know, if we made a movie with you, you wouldn't have to worry about doing the action sequences, because we have all like in-house team that does that. And she's like, no, I actually would want to do the action scenes. And what came out of that story, I think, for a lot of people who are predisposed to feel this way is, oh, so Marvel just hires directors to do like the actor stuff, and then they have their team do the action stuff. And I would say that with Bone and Fleck, not only are the action sequences just kind of mediocre, which is disappointing, it doesn't feel like their movie in any way. I mean, you can make the argument with Black Panther that movie still felt like part and parcel with themes that Ryan Coogler has been interested in his previous movies. And Captain Marvel is screenwriters. The screenwriters are Bone and Fleck and like one other person. So it's not like they don't have anything to do with the film. But to me, was disappointing, especially as a big fan of Sugar and Mississippi Grind, two movies I think that really understood this is the type of movie that we're making, and we're really going to kind of like dig into that kind of movie. This movie feels like, well, it's a comic book movie, but there's nothing very sort of distinctive. There's some, I liked some of the music and some of the score in this film where it's almost like retro sci-fi in a fun way. But again, I am not somebody who says the filmmaker should have done it like this because it's, you know, their job and who cares what I think. But it's funny that you make a movie set in 1995 and there's actually nothing very distinctively 1995 about the film except for, hey, remember this? And hey, remember this? And of course, Will, I fondly thought of you when a Thomas guide is brought up at one, one important plot point in the movie. But there's not much, actually 90s about it. I mean, one of the things that's, that I actually sort of had wished with the music is if they had just done female artists from the 1990s, which they do like maybe a half. But it actually felt like that, because one of the things that I think of in terms of 1990s music is there were a couple different Years of the Woman, you know, whether it's Liz Phair or Hole or Bikini Kill or L7, you had all these different artists.
Or even the Lilith Fair, if you got to go in that.
Yeah, like there's a certain amount of like that was actually seen as an era that was going to maybe kind of break this stranglehold in rock music and have more female artists. It doesn't go that direction either, which I found is sort of disappointing. And again, filmmakers can do what they want, but when I find myself thinking, oh, that would have been fun, it tends to indicate something that is lacking in the experience of watching it. Now, all that being said, this movie is sort of like kicky and fun and breezy. The thing I think that also works for it is it's not quite to the level of an Ant-Man and the Wasp, which I know I like better than you do, but it has that same kind of idea where really this is not one of the Marvel movies where, and if we don't succeed, the whole universe will be destroyed. The stakes are actually a little bit lower. I think that helps this movie. There is a certain kind of like winning modesty, which is a weird thing to say about a Marvel movie, but I think that is true in this case, that there is something kind of smaller scale, which actually works to the film's benefit. It's fun to see Samuel L. Jackson, and you're right. I mean, as they've done in the last couple like Marvel movies, the youthening thing is working really well. Like that technology is really impressive. But I, you know, this is Doctor Strange. Like this is that kind of movie where it's fun and I enjoyed myself, but there's not much that I thought about after it was over.
Yeah. I think she carries a lot of it. And realize part of this job, movie's job too, is to sell her, right? To sell her not just like as like a leading star, but to sell her as now, again, I will be careful of spoilers, particularly post-credit spoilers, but eventually she's going to have to hang out with Iron Man, and she's going to have to hang out with Black Widow, and she's going to have to hang out with Captain America, and you have to believe her to be able to do that. I would argue this movie gets her over in that regard, and while that's congratulations, one corporate entity has successfully transitioned into another corporate entity, way to go. I feel like cheering for that is like cheering for box office receipts. Mm-hmm. It's very strange to me to see people cheering for box office receipts. I don't mean to be like, not like, like I don't know, to get back to 90s guy again, but like it does feel weird to see people like so happy to see Disney make so much money. Like it's weird that everything has become so politicized now that the notion that like, yeah, victory for Disney making so much money and whatever. I get it. I get the fact that there's a non-zero possibility that the two highest grossing Marvel movies are going to be Black Panther and Captain Marvel. That means something. And I feel like that, I think it's worth cheering for with the idea like, okay, maybe we're going to get more movies like this. And I think Marvel already is kind of going in that direction. And I understand that idea. It still feels weird to be so happy about Disney making a ton of money. I don't mean to be, you know, Johnny no sellout guy, but it just feels weird.
Yeah.
For me.
No, I agree. I mean, it's in the Mel piece I wrote. That's one of the things I've said. It's like, you're rooting for a company portfolio, which is, I mean, and I think that is the thing that, you know, again, not to be angry 90s guy, but I think the other problem with that is that it's an important thing, I think, for people who are rooting for this movie, like myself, to keep in mind, which is that we are rooting for a more progressive culture and society. And Marvel really is thinking, well, if people think that, that's good, and we don't not care about that. But they would also, they're more concerned with making a big, like a big, big, big pile of money. And those are different impulses and desires. And so the thing that we are rooting for is in some ways different than what they are rooting for. The other thing I want to say about Brie Larson really fast is that I was thinking about Short Term 12 recently, just because, you know, as has been mentioned since Rami Malek won for Bohemian Rhapsody, like, again, as we even talked about at the time when we did the reboot for the movie, like, of indie movies like the last 5-10 years, holy cow, that movie was like this perfect jewel of all these great up-and-coming actors all at the same time. And the thing that Brie Larson did in that movie is not that different than what she does in Captain Marvel, which is she has, you know, she is a sensitive character and a vulnerable character, but there's also a certain amount of like a really appealing smartass quality to her. And the, one of my favorite moments in the movie in Captain Marvel, it's really small and it's in the trailers, I know, but when she's like in the middle of an action scene and she blows her bangs out of her hair or out of her face, out of her eyes real fast with her mouth, and she's like, does that really fast. It's such a perfect human moment in the movie. And those types of things, I mean, even like something like Trainwreck, I think she has this ability of being a movie star, but still kind of just, I don't want to read too much into the fact that she's talked about being an introvert, but it feels like a person who is being a movie star, but at the same time, in her own way, going, yeah, but I'm just me. I'm not like a movie star. And Captain Marvel, I think, as a character, sort of works well in the same way. The moment that you are talking about, by the way, Will, I think I know what you're talking about in terms of a moment that's supposed to do a certain type of thing and is pretty affecting. I thought it worked pretty well too, I have to say. I actually thought it worked pretty well. I've talked to other people who have referred to it as the Nike commercial moment, which I get. But I actually thought it was pretty effective. And I have to say, those moments were enough to make me say, ultimately, yeah, I would give this movie a thumbs up.
All right, so what did you end up giving?
I gave it a B-.
Yeah, I give it a B. I think I'm a little bit higher than you are, but you're a little higher on the Ant-Man movie. So do you like this better or worse than the Ant-Man movies?
I like Ant-Man and the Wasp better than this. I like this better than the original Ant-Man, which, remember, I did not actually like. I think Ant-Man and the Wasp, that movie has less pressure on it. Ant-Man and the Wasp is breezier and funnier, and it knows what it's doing and does that thing, where this one feels a little bit more, as you said so well, the law of masters this one's serving. And so it's a little bit more kind of jumbled. But they stuck the landing enough where now it's like, I would be curious to see her in more things, which is good because she's going to be pretty important in Endgame.
There's going to be plenty, yes. All right, so that is Captain Marvel. Congratulations for all the money you made, Disney. It's nice to see good things happen to good people. All right, now I'm going to step away, Grierson, everyone's favorite part of every one of these here podcasts. I'm going to step away and be quiet and I'll let you talk about a couple of movies. So have a good time. Let me know when you're back. But for now, first off, you're going to be talking about Gloria Bell.
Because it gets me nowhere to tell you no.
Hi, Peter. I haven't heard from you in a while, so I thought I'd give you a call. That's it. I love you. It's your mother.
And life just goes by in a flash like that.
I know. You tell me the same thing every 10 years.
Gloria Bell is the new and old movie from director Sebastian Lelio, who won, he directed A Fantastic Woman, which won the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar in 2018. And Gloria Bell, as a lot of people probably know, is a remake of his own film, Gloria, which he made in Chile before A Fantastic Woman. This movie, I keep being told, is a shot-for-shot remake. I haven't seen Gloria in quite some time, so I'm going to take it on faith that it is a shot-for-shot remake. It sure feels close in certain ways. Plot-wise, because it's been a while since I've seen the movie, I don't remember all of the ins and outs, but I'll just pass on the information. It's a shot-for-shot remake. This one stars Julianne Moore as Gloria Bell, and Gloria is a woman they never say for sure, but I would say probably mid to late 50s, just like Gloria in the first movie. And it is a story about her life as a middle-aged woman, which should not be that interesting, but because so few films are about women in their 50s, that alone is novel. She is divorced. She's been divorced for about 12 years. Her ex-husband is played by Brad Garrett. She has two adult children. One of them is played by Michael Cera. And she lives in Los Angeles. And, you know, she is, you know, smart, enjoyable, entertaining, relatively happy woman, but she is looking for love in her life. And the film follows her as she goes to this like dance club, partly because she just loves to dance, but also because she's sort of hoping to meet someone. And one day she does. His name is Arnold, played by John Turturro. He is also divorced. He's been divorced for about a year. And, though they're both middle-aged and have had their ups and downs sort of romantically in their life, they decide to sort of take a chance on each other. And Gloria Bell, the movie, is about what happens to the two of them. Sebastian Lelio is a filmmaker I really do like. I think that he is a guy who's really, really good at telling sort of sensitive stories in a way that kind of get away from the cliche of being sort of sensitive or well-observed or all those kinds of words, or another word I love to use, lovely. But they're also really sort of smart, and they are well-observed, and I think he kind of gets all the little details right. Last year, he also directed Disobedience with Rachel McAdams and Rachel Weisz. And Gloria Bell, I like just about as much as I like the original Gloria. Julianne Moore is an actress that I have loved for a very, very long time. Speaking of the mid-90s, whether it was Shortcuts or especially Safe, which I still think is the best thing that she has ever done, or frankly, any actor has done in the last 30 years, I still just worship that movie. And what I think what connects a movie like Safe and the movie that she won the Oscar for, Still Alice, or a movie like Gloria Bell, is she has this incredible ability to be vulnerable in a way that still like radiates a lot of strength. And I sort of hate talking about female characters in the guise of like strength and weakness and things like that. But I think what she does in Gloria Bell is really give you the sense of a woman who is more than just holding it together. She's, you know, she has a job. She's a mom of two kids. You know, she knows how to kind of live her life, but at the same time has a lot of sort of fragile elements to herself, and how Julianne Moore sort of conveys those characteristics, how you sort of learn things about the character simply by the way Gloria reacts to things and the way her face changes in certain moments is really, really terrific. I think there's a certain kind of ceiling to a movie like this simply because there's not a lot of story. You really are just sort of spending time with this character. The film is very much a character study. But John Turturro is really good. Michael Cera is really good. Brad Garrett is also really quite good in a pivotal scene as the ex-husband. But the movie, you know, starts and ends with Julianne Moore. She's just terrific in this. This is the type of movie that will be forgotten at the end of the year because it's not sort of special enough. But this is a great performance. It's really, really good. I gave it a high B+. The next movie I'm going to discuss while Will is away is the documentary Apollo 11. Apollo 11 is a documentary directed and produced and edited by Todd Douglas Miller, who a few years ago made a documentary called Dinosaur 13 about a group of paleontologists, I hope I got that right, who discovered a full Tyrannosaurus Rex skeleton, which was an amazing discovery. And that documentary was about all the sort of heartbreak that happened after they discovered that skeleton. Apollo 13 is a very different story. There's no heartbreak here. It is about the Apollo 11 mission back in July of 1969. As you may remember, after about a decade's worth of preparation and previous missions, America and NASA got a man on the moon, Neil Armstrong, and also Buzz Aldrin. And what Apollo 11 is a collection of all of the footage that NASA shot at the time of the mission. And so Apollo 11 is a film where we see the preparation for the launch, the actual launch, the landing on the moon, and the safe return of the three astronauts back to Earth. So, spoiler alert, you get to see the whole thing. And what is consistently sort of impressive is not only has the footage been restored, it's playing in IMAX in some parts of the country, it is kind of an impressive feat in terms of how much stuff they shot and how much you just sort of get to be in the world of this mission as it's happening. There's also like something like, I don't know, 150,000 hours of audio that they found. So you also get to like hear the astronauts talking to mission control as they're going through the mission. And you sort of like learn how they kind of pulled this off. Because I have to say, watching this stuff from 1969 and seeing the technology that they had is to me even more incredible that this ever happened in the first place. Because the technology is not so advanced that you're kind of wowed by it. It actually seems incredibly primitive, which makes the whole operation even more impressive. This is probably the best reviewed movie of the year, and I definitely like it. I have a feeling that my good friend and colleague Will is going to like this movie more than I do, and one of the reasons why I think he will like it is because it does a thing that he especially likes, which is about smart people doing smart things and getting things done. Because Apollo 11, the movie, is entirely about sort of the miracle of science and people just problem solving, figuring things out, getting things done. And for people who are sort of inclined to really kind of geek out about this stuff, you are going to love this movie. I also have some friends who are big kind of NASA freaks. They also really love this movie. My only big reservation is that while the footage is really impressive and it's really kind of stunning to see it all up there on the screen, once you, I think, get used to how the film is put together, how it's structured, the wow factor starts to diminish a little bit. And so it's still really impressive, but it feels more like a historical document than necessarily an incredible documentary feat. One of the things that is very cool is that the music is by a composer named Matt Morton, who only used instruments that were in existence by 1969. So it's kind of a, it's not necessarily a retro soundtrack, but he's only using instruments that existed 1969 and prior. There's a lot of really cool stuff about this film. In some ways, the story of the making of the film I found more satisfying than the movie itself. That being said, this is one of those, if you can see it on a big screen, definitely see it on the big screen. I gave this movie a high B. That's it for me, ladies and gentlemen. Let's bring Will back.
All right, Grierson. I think I'm probably going to see both of those movies. I'm not going to lie to you. Because first I was going to ask you a question about them, but I like the rhythm of... one of my favorite things to do is to go back. I get to do what regular listeners do every week, which is when you I see a movie that I know that you've talked about solo earlier, and I see it like, you know, weeks or however later I see it, I can then go back and listen to you talk about it and yell at you. I disagree. That's one of my I assume readers do this all listeners do this all the time, right? When they're listening to the podcast, they get like angry. They're like, oh, for crying out loud, Grierson's wrong about this, and Will's right about this, and Grierson's wrong about this, and Leach has totally nailed this point. But how could Grierson feel this way about this? He's so wrong. He should listen to Will more. I assume all readers actually listeners actually do that. I like to be able to have that opportunity when I go back and listen to one of you.
And I want you to continue to believe that.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. I appreciate
it. You're very welcome.
All right, now it's time for our reboot movie. Our reboot movie this week is The Apartment.
Ingredient number one, a very warm, very wonderful story about a boy, a girl, and a very special kind of problem.
Did you hear what I said, Miss Kubelik? I absolutely adore you.
Shut up and deal.
The Apartment came out in the summer of 1960. It is directed by Billy Wilder. It won the Oscar for Best Picture that year, and it stars Jack Lemmon as C.C. Baxter, but most people just call him Bud. He works for an insurance company in New York City, and as he narrates throughout the movie, he is working his way up sort of the corporate ladder. He really kind of believes that if he sort of applies himself and works really hard, he can become an executive sooner rather than later. One of the things he's doing to sort of help that cause is he is sort of lending out his apartment in the city to some of his bosses and superiors who need a place to have their trysts. Tryst is a word I miss, by the way. Tryst is not used enough, and I'm going to use it as much as possible in this reboot discussion. But he lends out his apartment in the city to his bosses so they can have their trysts, their flings, with their girlfriends and mistresses. This is sometimes an occupational hazard because sometimes Bud isn't able to get into his apartment until very late in the evening when they finally leave. Also, all the noise that his bosses are making is keeping his neighbors up and causing lots of complaints. But yet, Bud thinks he is on the right path. He is really kind of, he's a bachelor himself, but he is really kind of attracted to this woman named Fran, played by Shirley MacLaine. And Fran operates one of the elevators in the building where he works. And, but the reputation that she has around the office is that, you know, she won't give anybody the time of day in the office. Everybody tries to hit on her, but she just sort of demurs and sort of turns them all away. And so Bud doesn't think too much of it. But then one day he is brought into the office of the personnel manager named Jeff Sheldrake, played by Fred McMurray, who years ago was in Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity. And Sheldrake wants him in his office for two reasons. Number one, to confirm that he is, in fact, the guy who is lending out his apartment to people in the building. And number two, how he can be on that list, because he, Sheldrake, also has a mistress that he sort of wants to bring over there. Turns out, you guessed it, it's Fran, played by Shirley MacLaine. I saw this movie for the very first time in a theater. And of the reboot movies, in terms of, as our reboot requester mentioned, sort of old movies, you know, you don't always need to see them in a theater. It's harder and harder these days to see older films in theaters, unless you have like a revival house nearby you. The Apartment, I have to say, is a movie that really lends itself to the big screen, because this movie is absolutely gorgeous. Its production design, the way it's shot, this is one of my favorite life in the big city, life in New York movies. It's shot in black and white. And whether it's the way that the sort of office where Bud works initially, the way that's designed and the forced perspective they use in that, or just the city itself, also his apartment. I'm not sure how he could afford his apartment, but let's not ask questions like that. It's just a beautiful looking movie. This to me is a movie that captures the sense of kind of the urban romantic sort of metropolis that as a kid, I really, really kind of gravitated to, maybe because we lived in a small town, which did not have anything that looked like anything in The Apartment. You know, Billy Wilder has many sort of classic films, many that are just beloved. The year before The Apartment came out, Some Like a Hot came out. A lot of people love Some Like a Hot. A lot of people love Sunset Boulevard. A lot of people love Double Indemnity. A lot of those movies are either sort of critically acclaimed or big hits or both. But The Apartment's the one that won Best Picture, the ones that I have cited. And maybe it's because I'm slightly protective and such a big fan of The Apartment. I don't feel like this movie has entirely gotten its due, which is a weird thing to say about a movie that won Best Picture. But despite a couple reservations we'll get to in a little bit, I really love this movie. And one of the things I love about it is that Will mentioned an allergy to Fred Armisen earlier in the podcast. This is the Jack Lemmon that I don't entirely always love. And there are moments in this movie where he also kind of makes me cringe a little bit. He's cutesy in this movie. There is no question about it. But the chemistry that he has with Shirley MacLaine and how terrific the two of them are and how terrific especially Shirley MacLaine is in this movie, it still feels fresh for a movie that's, you know, almost 60 years old. And the themes of this movie still feel incredibly fresh and contemporary. I mean, looked at in a certain perspective, this is a movie about two people who have committed suicide who find each other. And that still feels grown up in a way where it doesn't feel sort of like they didn't sort of like juvenile or make it more kind of juvenile. It feels adult in a way that I really sort of appreciated, because it's a Billy Wilder movie. It's really well written. It's really well constructed. It's just a smart movie. The critic Danny Perry once complained that, you know, don't any of these people realize that hotels exist? And I understand that point, but I think the argument against that would be they don't want to have any sort of paper trail in terms of or any sort of like proof. If they go to this apartment, then no one really knows except for Bud, and Bud's not going to talk because he's their underling. So even that reservation does not, in fact, bother me. The apartment is a movie. You know, Billy Wilder's had like a lot of great movies with a lot of great last lines. The Some Like It Hot last line is fantastic. I don't want to diminish that. But this movie's last line is also really great. And I think it builds in a way where it totally pays off where this whole movie has been going. I have a couple reservations we'll get to in a bit. I am so glad this movie was requested as a reboot because I love this movie.
I love it too. I don't love it quite as much as you do, but I do like, it's funny. It's hard not, I mean, to see, particularly in the year 2019, right? To watch the office environment in this movie. And a lot of times I found myself watching and be like, okay, obviously this movie's made in 1960. How much is it commenting on this office environment? And I have to say, I actually feel there is, while still acknowledging that it's a movie of its time, I do feel it is pretty indicting of it. And I feel like to me, the scene I found myself really kind of actively surprised by is actually the one where Bud discovers that Fran is in fact the woman with the cracked mirror, right? And they're at this crazy party, this crazy office party, and it really, there's something quietly depraved about it. Like, it feels a little like capitalism run amok, right? Like, it just feels like and maybe because I'm in Jupiter, Florida, surrounded by Trump properties. So like, but there seems something about watching it and watching like the way that that Sheldrake just like feels obligated, just feels it, like he deserves everything. Like, everything he gets, everything he has, everything he wants, he is entitled to it. It is his, and he should be able to take it. And everyone seems to have that in this office. And what I find kind of interesting about it is the way that Bud is not a perfect dude to any stretch of the imagination, but the fact that he just has like a little bit of respect for other human beings just gets him trampled on over and over and over by people who will get away with it, who will do whatever they want and whenever they want to. And no one will ever stop them. And I found that 50 years later or 60 years later, not something that doesn't feel particularly true as of now. And I do feel like while it is still a little bit jarring to, because I mean, in 1960, there's a certain nods to the world of 1960 and the way, and there were parts of, you never watched Mad Men, right?
I watched like the first season, but yeah.
Yeah, there are parts where Mad Men is sometimes a little bit too, hey, just so you know, we know what they're doing is bad. And so, like, obviously this comes, like, more in the moment of time. So this feels like it's both fluent in the language of the time while and the office culture of the time while still being a little indicting of it, which I kind of appreciate while still not being going all the way because it's taken in 1960. I do feel like a couple times, I find it interesting, I was doing some research on the movie, I had forgotten that when Kevin Spacey won Best Actor for American Beauty, he said he dedicated to Jack Lemmon, who of course who was his hero. He did this great impression of Jack Lemmon, actually, who was saying for the Oscar he should have got for The Apartment. And Sam Mendes was talking about how he thought of The Apartment when he's making American Beauty. I think those are the parts of The Apartment that actually don't work very well, is anytime there's trying to make some sort of comment on the way they're living right then. There's a scene where Jack Lemmon is watching television at home, and it feels like a annoying comment on television in the way that American Beauty had like tons of annoying comments about everything. And there's a couple times where I feel like the movie doesn't feel dated when it's about Sheldrake and about how much of a jerk he is. That feels kind of timeless. It feels kind of important today. There are times where it feels like we're trying to comment on, here's a, like some of the jokes feel current in a way that that don't hold up today and you wish they wouldn't have bothered. So there's a little bit of that in there. I agree, Lemon is a little mannered, but like he's so fun to watch. Like I just, like even, like to me, Jack Lemmon is one of those actors that even when he is, and this is when he's really dialing it up, like this is still early enough in his career where he's twitchy and he's always moving his hands around and he's just letting you know that he is being very quirky and charming at all times. It is a bit much, and I'm glad he would later dial it down in his career. I still found it incredibly entertaining and loved the two of them together so much. There's something incredibly inherently formidable about her from the first minute you see her. And obviously, she has her all sorts of her own issues of her own, but there is something strong and formidable about her that you kind of just you catch absolutely immediately. That really works. So I would not say this is my favorite Wilder film. I wouldn't even consider it probably my top three, but it is really good. And it is, I did find stuff, a lot of stuff that held up more than I might have necessarily thought it would have.
Yeah. I think I especially appreciated that, that Fran is, you know, even though she's the one that, you know, takes the pills and is sort of like waylaid for part of the movie, the movie doesn't make it like, he doesn't really rescue her. And that's kind of in terms of this idea of it being somewhat more modern than maybe one might expect. I was actually really impressed by that she is strong-willed and independent enough that it's not like she's with this married man. This is bad for her. Jack Lemmon swoops in and kind of makes everything better. That's not really how the movie plays out. I was really, really appreciative of that. And yeah, I mean, like I said, the moments where Lemon was allowed to improvise, you can kind of tell. Like, it just has that quality to it. Watching it this time, I was also thinking, it's funny to think of Bud growing up to become the guy in Glengarry Glen Ross. It's really just sort of like, because the what is, and I think that's a testament to Lemon as an actor, is that the same kind of wide-eyed, optimistic, lovable quality that he brings to Bud becomes desperate and sweaty and much more kind of bitter when it's plugged into Glengarry Glen Ross, because that guy has like 25, 30, you know, years more into him, and life has like kicked him in the teeth a lot more. And so it's sort of actually kind of fun to sort of think of, especially I think as Lemon got older,
It's Fred McMurray in 1960 and it's Alec Baldwin in 1991, right?
Yeah, in a certain way. And also,
like the same assholes. The same assholes have been kicking the deep for 30 years.
And the other thing also, like, I mean, to your point about, like, because I think with both with Bud and with Fran, they are people who are kind of on the bottom level of this society. And Bud, his strategy is very much like, hey, I'm not going to let anything stop me from getting ahead. This movie is that rare exception for me of a movie whose plot is don't tell somebody something and keep playing along as if it's something else. And the tension is, when will people find out? Usually that plot drives me a little crazy. I think it actually works pretty well in this, partly because for Bud, you can kind of see what the stakes are in terms of why he doesn't want to rock the boat, because he doesn't want to lose his promotion. He doesn't want to lose his office. I mean, one of the great moments for me in this movie is he gets the promotion. He takes all his stuff. He goes into an office where he gets to see the other people where he used to sit. That is considered the triumph. And then eventually he starts to move his way up to the 37th floor or whatever it is. And I think I also think, as we talked about for Double Indemnity all those years ago for the reboot, Fred McMurray is known kind of in the culture as being like this lovable dad character. And these two movies that he did with Billy Wilder are the movies that people forget in terms of him just being really dark. And I really love that you said that, Will, about like there is something that's kind of perfect about Sheldrake sort of being like, he is so unkind to Fran, and not like unkind in a cruel, intentional way. It's sort of like, why are you being such a pain? Like this is ridiculous. You shouldn't be acting this way. And there's something about that that's so incredibly dismissive, that's perfect. Without making him an overly monstrous villain, you go, what a creep this guy is. But at the same time, I completely bought why Fran would be kind of drawn to him in the first place. He's very handsome. He's somewhat charming. He keeps making these promises. Yeah, I mean, is it my favorite? I really love Sunset Boulevard too. I'm really, really partial to that movie as well. And there's other ones of his I like quite a lot. But these are probably my two sort of favorites of Billy Wilder movies.
Yeah, it's funny. This is something to remember for all actors who, when they get older, take a more family-friendly or, say, a superhero movie. Like, the idea that, like, I grew up only knowing Fred McMurray as the flubber guy. Like, that's just how I knew him. And then later on learning about all this stuff. And you realize there are people out there who only know, like, Michael Douglas as the uncle in Ant-Man. So on. Like, it's always, it's a good cautionary tale to keep in mind that, like, eventually, like, I didn't, like I was going to grow, like, I knew, of course, the flubber. I didn't know him as the guy from Double Indemnity in The Apartment. Like, I knew him as that. So it's always a good reminder that that everyone all watching movies for the first time will never, growing up and watching kids' movies, no one's going to know that Annette Bening was they're never going to think of The Kids Are All Right. They'd be like, oh, well, she was a good actress before she was whatever weird character she is in Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
I always try to keep that in mind.
Yeah. And by the way, $1 million, I could not name the Annette Bening character. She's Webster or something. It starts with a W, I think, or something like that. Yeah. For me, the thing about The Apartment, we've sort of circled around it a little bit. I just think that movie speaks to, like, urban loneliness in a really kind of great way. Like, being in a big city, working a big job, lots of people around you, still being sort of inexpressibly lonely at the same time. I think this movie totally, totally captures that.
And it's also, I mean, let's not forget, it's really, really funny.
Yeah, and it's also really, really, and it's funny because I feel like people don't talk about I think people think of The Apartment maybe as more of a romantic movie, which I think it is, but it's also, especially I think in its first half, I think like the first like 60 minutes of this movie are really like, laugh out loud kind of over and over and over again, even more than I like Some Like It Hot. I would actually be curious to do a reboot of that movie. As a quick side note, I actually rewatched like maybe 45 minutes of that on around Christmas this year. TCM had, I was kind of watching it again. Even that time I was like, I really like this movie, but I don't find it as funny as I know a lot of people do. I actually laugh more at The Apartment.
All right, Kirsten. Well, that's The Apartment. Good stuff. Excellent, excellent run there. I fun with the Wikipedia page, by the way. There have been two black and white movies to win Best Picture since The Apartment.
I saw that, yes.
We're going to give our readers a moment to try to guess, and then you can tell us the answer, Kirsten. 3, 2, 1. What's the answer?
The Artist. I'm sure I can actually remember this. I'm going to look. The Artist in Schindler's List. You know.
That's correct.
Three movies that are very, very similar.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So that's saying, so this is 1960. So this is the Psycho year. Which do you prefer, this or Psycho?
That's a really tough one. I think they're both tremendous. That would be that top 10 list that year between those two. And I'm sure someone else is yelling, who's listening, what about Peeping Tom? Peeping Tom is also really good, but Psycho and The Apartment are both really, really, really good. I might give the edge to Psycho.
Yeah, I think I would too. I would give the edge to Psycho as well. The movie Cimarron came out in 1960. Dinosaurs! Dinosaurus.
You know what else came out that year, by the way? I think Inherit the Wind. Wasn't that the year too? I was married.
Inherit was the Wind. Yes. Yes. Oh,
so
wow.
We're working
this
our way.
This movie feels a lot more current than Inherit the Wind.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
We're working our way very slowly through the most acclaimed movies of 1960 on the
Magnificent
reboot.
Magnificent Seven. This was quite a year.
Yeah.
Magnificent Seven came out.
Yeah, it's a really good year. I was doing a little looking. Why are we talking about this really fast? Yeah, it was like
Spartacus?
Yeah.
Christ.
It's a really good year. Really, really. People kind of talk about like the 60s sort of being like, oh, that was sort of the beginning of the end. And then, you know, the renaissance of the 70s, and there were bad movies in the 60s, obviously, but there's some really, really good stuff, especially in 1960.
All right, so that is The Apartment. Always nice to get a little Billy Wilder in here. And that is our show this week. That is our show. Next week, Grierson, we have one new movie. We got one new movie, Grierson. And that movie, it's Netflix, and the kids are liking the Netflix. In fact, apparently, if you're at like one or two theaters, you can actually watch this right now. But we're going to be watching it on the Netflix. Oh, you probably guys watched it on the Netflix as well. And that movie is Triple Frontier. Triple Frontier, directed by J.C. Chandor. Well, I feel like he hasn't done anything in a while. It's been all. Oh, he did Most Violent Year. I forgot about Most Violent Year.
But it's still been a few. It's been a few years though.
Most Violent Year was 2014. Yeah, it was 2014. But there was a stretch where he was really on quite the roll, right? He was on Margin Call, which I thought was really good. All His Loss, which I liked a little less. And but Margin, I forget how good Margin Call is. Margin Call's got some really good stuff.
Yeah, speaking of Kevin Spacey, yeah, no, Margin Call's really, really good. It's. I mean, it's very much a movie of its kind, but it's a really well-made movie of its kind. And this was pre us doing the podcast, but yes, I like All Is Lost more than you do. I think Redford's tremendous in that movie. And, you know, Most Violent Year I thought was okay. It was very much like, let's make a Sidney Lumet film. And in some ways it's a decent Sidney Lumet film, but this is an action thing from him.
Yes, this is famously the Ben Affleck with the back tattoo looking longingly onto the ocean movie, right?
I think that's correct.
I think it is.
I think that's right.
Yeah. So Ben Affleck, Oscar Isaac at last. Ben Affleck and Oscar Isaac.
Yes, I mean, and Oscar Isaac. I'm excited for that pairing. Three frontiers in this economy. Thank you.
Well, don't worry, because in the economy of 2012, which is where our first reboot movie next week, they didn't have any money, so they had to go with Zero Dark Thirty. Ha ha! Money puns. Is Zero Dark Thirty 2012, directed by Kathryn Bigelow. I would say still somewhat controversial. Zero Dark Thirty. I think it's probably a somewhat fair thing to say. If you remember, Gerson, this was my favorite movie of that year.
It absolutely was your favorite movie. I remember that very well. It was in my top 10, but it was your number one of that year.
Yeah. So, and I think perhaps the weirdest thing of watching this movie again, because I don't think I've seen it in quite a few years, will be, oh, right, it's not so funny when Chris Pratt is playing a Navy SEAL anymore.
Yeah. Chris Pratt's in this movie. Chris Pratt.
I'm excited.
Yeah. I'm excited. I've seen this movie a couple years ago. But I'm going to rewatch it for this. So it's fresh in my mind. So I'm very curious. I'm very curious to check it out. Yeah.
Okay. And then our final reboot next week is 2003's High Tension, directed by Alexandre Aja. Aja, they say. It is a French thriller.
It's not Asia, like the Steely Dan album. It's
Aja. Alexandre Aja directed High Tension. I've never seen this. It's like a horror movie, right? I've never seen this movie.
I have never seen it either. I can confirm it is a horror movie.
It is a horror movie. All right. Well, then I'll make sure not to watch it before I go to bed, because I get the heebie-jeebies when that happens.
That's actually a thing. I know people have that, right? They don't want to watch a horror movie before they go to bed because it freaks them out. I have to say that has never, I guess I'm lucky, that has never been a thing. It does not freak me out as much.
Yeah, well, I'm just going to be careful anyway because I'm in Florida. God knows what's going to happen to me here.
Yeah.
I'm just taking that.
Be careful when you flush the toilet, Will, while you're there, or watch out for drones. Something like drones happen sometimes. Where
I just assume like gators are going to come out through the sink. It's just going to happen.
Something horrible will probably occur. You know, I should probably find a guest host, because something will probably terribly happen to you next week by the time of next week. So yes, I'll start working on that now.
Three frontiers in this economy.
triple frontier in this economy that doesn't scan. So you have to switch it to three frontiers, which is I did the best with the material given to me.
Frontier, I barely know her. Okay, that's the best I could do there.
As always, ladies and gentlemen, you've got to the end of the podcast. Congratulations. Now you can to hear us
like,
as a
riff. Yeah, honestly, at this point, it's always just like, I feel like the only person that's still listening to this point is Keith Law, to see if I'm going to make a joke about whether or not you can take over the podcast from him.
Right. Yeah, I'm hoping that Nick Fury shows up, or somebody who wants to recruit us for the Avengers or something. Like this is the Deadpool movie. You've sat through the credits. Ryan Reynolds shows up at the end and makes fun of you for sticking around this long. We should actually now make news, because people are now thinking, oh, well, they're not going to tell us anything. But we actually don't have any news, so I guess we're just talking at this point.
It's probably time to go.
Yeah.
All right, Grierson, have a good week. We'll be back next week with Triple Frontier, Zero Dark 30, and High Tension. Have a good one, Grierson.
Bye.
Ball.
This shouldn't work, but it does. It only works because of us. And should anyone say different, it wouldn't matter at all. This only